Okay, how am I for volume? I guess I'm okay, huh? You can hear me? Yeah? You can hear me up top? Well, no, you can't. You could, but... I can't compete. Can you hear me in the back row? No. Okay. Okay, we'll try that. Okay, now you can, right? You can hear me in the back row? No. Yes? Fine? Good? Okay. Oh, my goodness. Well, it's not really the last time we meet here because you get to do it again. We're having a birthday party on Friday at 4 o'clock, May 6th, right here. It's Sigmund Freud's birthday, Friday. So we will celebrate Sigmund Freud while we take the exam. Okay? Speaking of birthdays, I forgot to mention something on Monday. Last Friday was Yuri Bronfenbrenner's birthday. He was 88. And unfortunately, I had sad news on Thursday. I got a note from his wife. I had asked Yuri to write an introduction for the Developology book, and he had said a couple of years ago that he'd be happy to do that. So I had written him about 6 weeks ago, 5 weeks, and said it was time to do that. And his wife wrote back and said that he was quite ill and unable to work, and she wished us well. She was very happy. He was very happy that we're still teaching it. But his active career appears to have come to a stop. So that was my sad news. Yesterday was Julie's birthday, and she had a really weird day because her grandmother died yesterday morning. So that's why she's not here today and won't be with us on Friday. Things pass. People pass. It's part of life. Course has come to an end. But you'll never forget this one because you've been brainwashed, right? So we'll check on that. We'll test that on Friday. Review sessions today. You want less light or you want more bright? Both. There's more bright. Lights are already down. Okay. And tomorrow at 12:30 in Living Learning, and the final exam Friday here at 4. Bring a number 2 pencil. Because we will have an obnoxious Scantron thingy to do that. Questions? The test has a multiple choice section and short answer section and short essay section. No true false. So we try to keep it varied so it'll tap into your strength. Covers everything, all of Bronfenbrenner, all the reading. I've been asked several times about the depth of coverage of the reading. You don't have to memorize the reading. I won't ask picky questions, but you should be able to summarize the main points of each of the readings, at least in your own head, and be clear about what those are. And then explain them using Bronfenbrenner. Because what we're trying to write are questions that use the material from the reading, the main ideas from the readings, to connect to and illustrate the developmental principles. So you should have it at that level. But I won't ask picky little details like what percentage of U.S. households, whatever. I can't even make up that kind of question. Even as an example, so you're safe. Okay. Other questions about the exam review sessions or anything else? I am committed either to a psychiatric unit or to having the papers here at the final exam graded with grades on them. Yep. Yes. On assignment 6? Sure. Let me see if I can do that off the top of my head. I haven't thought about summarizing. Assignment 6 is really fun to read. And I'm also trying to capture, I asked Julie to generally give me her reaction. She read all of them and I'm reading all of them. So we have our different perspectives on them. First, most of the writing is really good, which I always like because it makes reading the papers easier. And there are some that are not particularly well written, and typically you will get another suggestion if you haven't already gotten them to use the Writing Center to pay attention to writing, to spend your summer reading good writing. Good literature. Okay. Don't watch television this summer. Read good literature. Julie's comment about assignment 6 was that they were fun. They were very interesting. There were some common threads that people picked up on. So there was some consistency in them, particularly on the kinds of relationships that people want to create with their children. And that was the section, in her view, that people were, that was the set of concepts that people were clearest about. The kind of affect, the kind of joint activities, the harmoniousness of the pattern of the microsystem that people want to create. They were incredibly varied because we didn't give you a specific format. People used your own creativity. So they were very different in style. Some of the rules were very straightforward and simple, and then backed up well with developmental concepts. Some of the rules were very complex and very specifically cited developmental concepts within the rules and then backed them up. And that was just the difference in style and the way people were thinking about it and how you interpreted the assignment. We didn't have any preset notions about the kind of language that you should create or the level of complexity of the rules and that was not a factor in the grading. So we took what you did with it. What we were responding to was, did you cover the ecosystem generally? Did you support the rules effectively with develop logical principles? Do they make sense? And there's a wide range. Some of you wrote nice rules, but you could have written them before you took the course and without any reference to develop ecology, and that wasn't the assignment, at least not the way we hoped. There weren't many of those. There were two or three. And then some of them are just wonderful. Some of them are just really very thorough, very clear rules, very nicely detailed. But what was clear in reading them was that there's a wide range, as one would expect, for that kind of assignment. The I think Julie and I both saw the same common element missing, and that was very few people actually talk specifically about the macro system, and very few people talk specifically about the exosystem. And that's understandable, I think, certainly expectable. I would have predicted that, because the macro system is still one of the more difficult concept, and it's the one that that Bronfenbrenner himself does not deal particularly in depth with, although it's an important concept for him. And as a result of reading both assignment 5 and assignment 6, I've been making notes toward expanding the section in the book on the macro system with more examples and hopefully more detail, more useful detail, so that it might make more sense. Those were expectable. People were focusing on the dyad and the microsystem and the mesosystem, and I think if I could characterize them, and I really appreciate your question, if I hadn't, and if I seem a little disfluent, it's because I hadn't tried to put this together in my head yet. I think you ought most, as a class, as a group, at least for those of you who wrote it, you're clearest about the dyadic relations and the nature of relationships. And I think you've really captured what it means to create a developmental dyad, and what that would mean for parenting. And that was the gist of most of the papers, had that very nicely detailed and supported. And then I think you're in pretty good shape about understanding the interrelatedness within the microsystem, that it really is a system, and that the roles and the activities and the relationships are all related to each other, and many of the rules that were very clearly stated were about creating molar activities, and many of them expanded that to developmental trajectories for kids. Many of the rules focused on joint activities with kids and the importance of those becoming more complex. So I think you've really got that part of it. And then a little less clarity about the mesosystem and the managing the mesosystem for kids. A lot of the rules focused on making mesosystem settings available for kids as part of parenting. You need to make those opportunities available. And much less support within those. What I would have liked to have seen, waiting for the next paragraph, and it often didn't happen, was how you create the links. Yeah. Getting your kid to soccer is only part of creating the mesosystem. Creating the links. What do? You drop your kid at soccer and then go do something else. How involved are you? How much of a joint activity do you make it? how much involvement do you have with other people? Do you make the activities that are important to you to provide for your child? Do you support their complexity? And do you support a mesosystem that connects those for the child, and connects those settings for the child? So that was the piece that I would suggest that you think about, that the parental role of managing that mesosystem and being involved in joint activities with the kids in different settings and with the people who are with your kids in other settings as well. So there's more connection across the mesosystem. And then, as I said, Pure talked about the exosystem, but that seems to me to be an important part of thinking about Bronfenbrenner, that there are lots of places where decisions are made, policies are generated, people are hired that will have an impact on your child. Your child won't be in those settings, but it's appropriate for parents to be aware of where those settings are and what goes on in them, and to make them part of their mesosystem, or at least communicate with them, to make a communication link on behalf of the child to the exosystem. And some of you wrote about that very nicely. And then the macro system, very few people actually tackled. And again, people wrote right up to the edge of it and then didn't take that next leap. Some of you talked about the importance of a spiritual dimension to the child's life, involving a child in your religious practice and your religious belief as part of the mesosystem system. Some wrote about involving the child in diverse cultural settings. And that would be an important connection. And then beyond that, I think Bronfenbrenner, I think a developmental approach would connect what the child brings out of, what the child gains in those multicultural settings, those diverse settings, about the child's view of the world. And the part that I didn't find in most of the essays was the parent's role in interpreting other macro systems. Help the child put multicultural experiences into perspective so that you use those multicultural experiences and those experiences with different religions, you know, whatever the macro system features are that you're having your child encounter, to use those to understand your own more fully, and also to appreciate better the complexity of the entire ecosystem, which includes potentially many macro systems. Some of you got the notion of having exposure to a variety, and I was waiting for you to support that with what that's going to do for the child's understanding of the world. That probably all sounds a little more critical than our reaction to the essays. Julie and I have both enjoyed reading them tremendously. There were very few that looked like they had been dashed off the night before. There are a couple, and you know who you are. We do too now. But for the most part, they were very thoughtful. It was clear, and many of you wrote that it was much harder to do than you expected. And we knew it was hard. And we're glad you found that out, too. And the ones that that I've read so far pretty universally are very thoughtful. You put a lot of time and effort into connecting Bronfenbrenner to this somewhat abstract question about parenting. And that's, I hope you'll take those lessons with you, tuck that essay away, pull it, or if you want to, you can leave it with me, like you did at camp. You do that at camp. You wrote a letter to yourself, and then at the new year, they sent it off to you. Well, I have things that I hold on to for students for 10 or 15 years. And you just, you know, you let me know you've had a child or you're getting married. I'll send it to you. And you can have it. You have to keep in touch. Okay. Enough? Let me just add one thing. I absolutely love reading the work that is done in this class. From the beginning, the very first exercise to the final exam. It's a real kick. I really enjoy watching people develop their understanding of these principles and how to apply them. And I can watch it grow. And it's fun because this is the kind of course where nobody has ever run into the vocabulary or the language or Bronfenbrenner before. I can pretty well guarantee that. So you get to start from the same point and then move it up. It's not like teaching chemistry where people come in and a lot of people already know the chemistry and some of them don't. Here I get to watch all of you develop your understanding of developmentology, and since that's my mission in life, it's nice that it happens. I will also appreciate the emails that you'll send over the years telling me that you use it constantly. I get those. Especially after people who take 161 in the fall, by the time you get through that, you can't not use a developmentological view of anything. And I regularly get emails from students who said, ran into it again. Why doesn't everybody know this stuff? Why don't people think like this? That's my goal. So feel free to write to me in 10 years and tell me that you have never, ever once thought about Bronfenbrenner or developmentology. Because I never hear from those people. You know, put it in perspective for me. Totally forgot what that course was about. Okay. Where are we? We're in divorce. Yeah, that's where we were. Oh, God. All right. I was rumbling on down through a kind of developmental chronology of what happens in divorce, and I had gotten all the way through to a binuclear family with some random comments about each phase. So I want to remind you that my starting point is that divorce is a process. It's a long process. Or you can think of divorce as a single milestone or event in a long process. And the developmental effects on everybody involved in it depend on how the ecosystem has been changed by the events and the relationships as they change, and then how the ecosystem has helped the participants make sense out of what's happening, and in the case of children, one of the crucial points that I try to get across is that the task is to get through the various milestones and events that are unpleasant and challenging, and get through them in a way that helps children keep on developing. Because like any other major change in the ecosystem, if it generates a lot of confusion and kids don't understand it, and the adults around them forget to maintain developmental dyads, kids' development slows down or comes to a screeching halt, or in some cases you get a lot of regression, and that creates even more problems, not only for the child but for the family that's trying to deal with them and for their caregivers. So one way to think about it is that you have a couple coming together, having children, creating the microsystem, and children are learning whatever they're learning in that microsystem. They're developing relationships, they're developing skills, they're developing a view of the world, and skills to deal with that. And in families where divorce is in the offing, the conflict and the negative affect and the molar activity of making other people miserable, which becomes a molar activity in the process of divorce for many people, it gets very creative and it has its own momentum, and it becomes more and more complex for them. People really devote themselves to making other people miserable, both within the microsystem and then after separation. They continue that, but it becomes a mesosystem process. So the participants in the marriage, the relationship, are engaged now not in the same setting, but in a mesosystem, and they're creating lack of goal consensus, they're creating conflict and disagreement, a discord between those two settings. Or not. And if they're doing it well, they're saying, okay, we have to separate now, let's see if we can do it in such a way that we don't make our kids any more miserable than they have to be. And that's one of the places where you can focus in intervention with people. It's a critical point for them when they separate. And it's a point at which typically people head to a lawyer's office, find out what their rights are, protect themselves, and attorneys are major players in helping people figure out how to create the mesosystem, particularly when there are children involved. And attorneys come in many stripes, but there's a continuum for me. And one is the attorney, the continuum for me is defined by the pole at one end where the attorney says, okay, we're going to take her for everything she's got and you're going to get full custody of the kids. Don't talk to her anymore. Take the kids away. And they support nastiness and negative affect. And they create problems for kids. And then at the other end are the people who can say when somebody comes in, okay, look, I'm happy to help you. Let's talk about what you're going to do with your kids. Let's talk about how you're going to keep this process. You're obviously very upset. How are you doing with your kids? How are you dealing with them? What have you told them? How are you helping them understand this? Who can help you do that? Who can be supportive for your kids? Let's see if we can make the decisions and get a resolution to this, get the divorce accomplished if that's where you're going. Let's see if we can do that in a way that doesn't do harm to your kids. Okay. Those are attorneys typically who've either had a lot of experience, and they are typically themselves parents or grandparents. They are people who see their mission in life not as screwing the opponent and getting everything possible for their client. That's one way to be a lawyer, if you want. They're people who see their job as helping their clients make sense out of life and protect them, but also they see the client as including the children. And one of the client's roles is as a parent. So those attorneys typically have studied family law. They typically they're either very old and experienced, or they are specialists who have gone into law in part because they want to help children. And those are the ones I try to refer people to. But your friends will tell you, go hire a barracuda And barracudas are not good for kids. Attorneys come in sharks, barracudas, and groupers. Groupers are nice fish. So the attorney and the relationship between the attorneys becomes an important part of the ecosystem for the parents and part of the ecosystem features for the child. Then what is happening over time through the separation, there's a legal process that's going on. It has some time limits in most states. Decisions are being made about money. Decisions are being made about parenting, schedules, where kids are going to be, who's going to take care of them, who's responsible for this or that or the other thing. And then eventually you have a formal divorce. And in most cases, that formal divorce is literally a judge looking at an agreement between two parents and signing it. Okay, the state blesses your dissolution of the contract between you that was formed when you got married. And the state has executed its responsibility to make sure your children are provided for. So we have a support agreement. We have the assets divided in a fair way. Go on about your lives. We don't care what you do from now on. Some divorces, and it's a minority, it's less than 10% in Vermont, include a period just before that signature happens in which parents go into a court hearing and bash each other and make all kinds of accusations and lie and bring in their friends to lie and to create as much hostility as they possibly can and turn over all the decision making to a judge because they can't agree. Then the judge, in a contested hearing, in a contested divorce, the judge becomes an incredibly powerful component of the ecosystem. And as one of my very favorite judges likes to describe it, he says, so, parents who are being unreasonable and can't come to agreement decide that they want a total stranger, me, to decide who gets the television, who has to take responsibility for the dog, what hours of the week their children can be with them, and who has to pass them back and forth, and who gets the house, and who's responsible for getting the kids' boots from one house to the other, and I'm going to tell them exactly how they have to parent and how to raise their child. And they're unhappy with me. But they're always unhappy with me. One of them is always unhappy. Or both of them, and she says her attempt, typically, is to try to make both parents unhappy with her. They're unhappy anyway, so what can she do? So she doesn't know the kids, she doesn't know the parents, she doesn't know anything about the kids' temperament, she doesn't have any idea how the kids are dealing with anything, and she refuses and is prevented by the rules of family court in Vermont from even meeting the children. They are totally irrelevant. But she's going to decide where they spend Wednesday night and how much time they spend with the parent because the parents can't agree. My very favorite is family court judges in Vermont are also likely to, in a contested hearing, to hear all of the testimony and then they will say, okay, I'm going to retire to my chambers, and in about 2 months, I'm going to give you an order that tells you what to do. Meantime, I'm going to give you my view of the ecosystem and suggest to you that you're both behaving abysmally. You should be ashamed of yourselves. You should remember that you're in developmental dyads with your children, and that both of you will continue to be in developmental dyads with your children, and your children really would benefit from third-party dyads that support each other. And those are my favorite judges. They don't use quite that language, but that's what they say. that you should be ashamed of yourself. You should think about your kids. You should try to figure out how you're going to get along, because you are going to get along for the rest of your life, or not. And to the extent that you don't, you're going to damage your children, and they don't deserve that. Okay, so then we recover. And what we're creating is a binuclear family. We're creating a mesosystem home. And both parents have the responsibility to create a microsystem that will foster the child's development when the child is with them, and a mesosystem that will foster the child's development. And all of Bronfman Brenner's hypotheses apply about goal consensus, face-to-face communication, clear communication, not using the child as a messenger, because that's a really indirect way to communicate. Doing it directly, being clear, maintaining positive affect, and when the child is in your home, supporting the other mesosystem. Ideally, people take a pledge back here never to trash the other parent, not to cry about what's going on with the other parent, not to use the child as a spy and then complain about what the other parent is doing, but create an atmosphere in which the two mesosystems can communicate openly and support the child's development. I hope I didn't say there were multiple mesosystems. What I hope I said, and if I didn't, erase, delete, and we'll, like, what you have is settings, mesosystem settings, and the relationship between them, which is mesosystem. What you have in this case is a mesosystem home, because you're looking at two microsystems, and the child is spending time in each of those, and the relationship between them, the mesosystem connection. So I hope I said that you want it to be multiply linked. I'll go back and listen to the recording and see if I... If I did misspeak, thank you for picking up on that. Okay? Then what happens after some period of time, ideally some period of time, is that the parents begin to extend their mesosystems, and each of them has a separate mesosystem, and they begin to develop dyadic relationships with other people who are potential partners. How they do that, how they bring those people into the microsystem where the child is, whether they do that, how quickly they do that, and the roles they define for people that they're dating, all affect the child's development. And you can think about that as the parental mesosystem affecting the microsystem, because maybe the child's not there. Maybe the parent's not there. The parent is off doing something else, and somebody else is taking care of the child while the parent is dating. Sometimes a parent dating, developing new relationships, increases the negative affect within that home mesosystem, because the parent who's not dating resents what's going on in that relationship. If the original conflict and separation was involved an external relationship before, then that relationship is not likely to be positive for a long, 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 long time. People who are involved in affairs, and one of Uncle Larry's advices is, if people are involved in affairs, they should keep them secret, period. And ideally, they should just not be in one, because they mess up. They mess up the messless system. For one parent to be involved, or for both parents to be involved in affairs at the time of separation and during the time of divorce, just simply fuels the negative affect between the parents. It's one of the ways of almost guaranteeing that that messless system will not be supportive of the child's development, because the parents will have created so much hostility. Right. The potential, it's only potential. High potential, but it's not always realized. But the potential is that the parent's involvement in other dyads interferes with the parent's dyadic relationship with the child. Okay, so go back to the Bronfenbrenner hypothesis about supporting dyad. What happens for most of us is when we're in a romantic relationship or trying to get laid, whatever the relationship is about, when we're putting time and energy into that relationship, we often are ignoring our parental relationship, the parent-child relationship. And those dating attempts, those attempts to create another dyadic relationship with an adult, often interfere with the parent-child dyad. It's possible to have relationships that don't create that kind of problem, but it requires that you keep your developmental dyadic relationship as a parent and your role as a parent foremost. That has to be the highest priority. And that's very difficult for some people to do. So, if we were being Bronfenbrennerian, we would say, remember that from the beginning, your role, the most important role you have, is the parental role. And you need to maintain that parental role through the separation. You need to maintain it after the divorce. You need to keep it your highest priority. You need to figure out how to do it in a microsystem that does not include a partner. You need to be able to find your emotional support with adults, not with your kids, but with adults who are not romantically involved with you and who will support your relationship with the child. And as you begin to date, it would be helpful if you kept your child's welfare right out there in front and restricted your dating to when the child was with the other parent, rather than letting it interfere with your time with the child. And it's helpful to define yourself and your role with potential people that you're, people that you're potentially partnering with. So you just tell them up front, I'm a package, and when I have my children, they come first. I'm a parent first. I'm a potential partner second or third or fourth, and my kids are more important than you are. And if it ever comes down to a conflict between our activities and my parental responsibilities, I will always choose in favor of my parental responsibilities. That's defining your role. It's saying parenting is a molar activity that is more important than whatever you might be doing with a future partner. So I can give you the script for that if you want. And then, see, what you've done is provide a test for a potential partner. A potential partner who says, that's baloney. If you're going to have a relationship with me, I have to be number one, is telling you, I don't respect you as a parent. I don't acknowledge that role. We're going to have major role conflict, and you need to say, sorry, I'll call you again when my kids go to college. But meantime, my kids are most important. What you want is a dating partner who will say,
I love you so much because you're such a committed parent. And I'll do anything I can to support you.
And that means when you have a big date and one of your kids is sick and the other parent can't fill in, you say, sorry, I'll talk to you on the cell phone, but I'm with my child. And then when you want that potential partner to say, okay, I'll go to the movie, it's fine. Call me and let me know how she's doing later. That's what you want. You want somebody who will support that role. If you are dating, at some point, some of you will date somebody who is in a co-parental situation. You want to be the person who supports their parental role. You want to do everything you can to promote good relationships between them and their children. There are other roles you can take. One is it's me or the kids, in which case you ought to be dropped. That's my macro system. My macro system says kids are more important than adult relationships. But, you know, I'm a childist. You know, they're feminists and they're childists. I'm a childist. There are other roles, and one of those roles is that you come in and say, okay, you're really messing up your kids, so let me take over. And I will come into your microsystem and become a substitute parent and rescue your children from you. And if you actually are not doing a very good job as a parent, that can be very tempting. So you start dating somebody who really wants to raise your kids for you and takes over. And that happens in both genders. So both fathers and mothers are susceptible to that. What happens with fathers often is that they've never really been involved as parents and responsible. They have an opportunity to learn to do it on their own, and most men are quite capable of learning if they will commit themselves to doing it, and improve their commitment to the parental role. That's one of the positive effects of divorce for both men and women, that they become more competent parents if they're working at it. But if you don't do that, then it's very tempting to have some nice woman who really understands kids and communicate with them and who actually can think about parenting to come in and rescue you, and that's great. So you marry her and everybody's fine, except your kids hate it. And you're continuing your pattern as a man, as a failure, as a parent. And any woman who would step in and do that probably deserves to have her head examined. But people do it all the time. Just be aware of it. It's the origin of the wicked stepmother stereotype, which is not a stereotype. It's based on reality in some stepfamilies. For the other, there are women who are overwhelmed by parenting by themselves, increasing their work responsibilities, not having enough resources. It's perfectly reasonable to be overwhelmed by your ecosystem and your responsibilities. And some women have difficulty becoming firm enough and structured enough for their kids at a time when their kids are really annoyed with the parents anyway. And the kids are creating problems between the meso system. And it's very tempting when some nice, strong guy comes into your life and says, I can straighten these kids out. And comes in like gangbusters and lays down the law and whops your kids when they're disrespectful to you and tells them what's what. And it can feel like being rescued. And it is being rescued. Kids, girls will hate it. Boys, they may say, okay, that's what we needed. In both cases, and in every other case, where you're bringing somebody in, you're creating a change in the microsystem, and it's helpful to analyze it that way, that you're in fact creating a change. You need to define the roles. They will be defined either by default or by definition. And they can be defined in ways that help kids develop. help support their development, or in ways that interfere. At the same time, you're creating a change in the mesosystem for the kids, because anybody who comes into either of the settings becomes a participant in the mesosystem, and it's the home mesosystem for the kids. And the relationship between those new people and the people in the other microsystem is crucial. And one of the things that can happen is that it increases the distance, the lack of communication, the negativity between the settings. And if you're doing it really well, it can improve the communication. But that's an individual matter. It depends on the people who are coming in and how the kids are responding and how each of those microsystems is working on its own, and then what the relationship is between them. The value of a developmental perspective is that you can take whatever the reality is that you're experiencing and figure out the roles, the communication, the activities, the relationships, and the congruence. You can figure out what is being harmful to the kids. And then you can make recommendations about how to improve it. So we need to define the step-parent role here. And a parent who comes in as a step-parent can define that role inappropriately or appropriately. You need to study the step-parent role. How do you define it appropriately? The step-parent role is not to come in and insist that children call him dad when there is a dad, active dad in their lives. To come in and replace the other parent, the parent of the same sex you are, and to insist on being treated as a parent is an inappropriate role for a step-parent. But step-parents do it. Both stepmothers and step-parents do that. And the younger the child, the more likely they are to try that. So what I see with divorced families is often a great deal of hostility developing because the parents in one setting are insisting that the two-year-old call the step or the boyfriend daddy. And the kid, of course, at two announces that to the real biological father in the other setting, and you have a war about usurping the role. And you should have a war, but the original, the family that created the problem, shouldn't do that. What is an appropriate role for step-parents? And if you have a really good step-parent, how is the role defined? Yeah. Another person, another adult, a responsible adult who cares about you. Yeah. That's the appropriate role. You're not a parent. You come into the microsystem as an adult who has partnered with the other adult in the microsystem, and the children will figure out their relationship with you. And discipline is the responsibility of the biological parent. So you don't get into that role. You can make suggestions. You can suggest to children what's appropriate and what's not. And you can set limits when you have to. I was involved in dating a woman who had two young children for a while. And there, as I got more involved with the family, there were times when I was the only adult in the house. And Mom would go off to do whatever she did, and I would say, sure, I'll be with kids for a while. No problem. We have great times. But every once in a while, you set some limit, and a kid throws out the classic line, "You're not my parent. You can't tell me what to do." And you expect that if you're an adult. Even if you're a daycare provider, you get that line. So anyway, you're not my parent. And you can't argue with that. No, I'm not your parent. I am, however, the responsible adult on the premises, and therefore it is my job to make sure that you stay safe, and there are certain things that you are not permitted to do to any adult, parent, or otherwise, including me. So here are the expectations. This is your role. And I'm not trying to be your parent. I would do the same thing for anybody your age who was in this setting. Nobody does that. That's clear. It's clean. And step-parents who do that eventually have kids who accept them. Well, most of the time. But they establish their own independent relationship. They create their own developmental dyad with the child on its own terms. And they're fine. And you defer to the biological parent at every possible moment, including the biological parent of the same sex. You don't compete with those people. So you can create the role and you can support the mesosystem for the child by not getting into conflict with the other parent. You don't compete. You don't try to outdo them. You defer to their role as parent all the time. Developmentally, that's pretty simple. It's hard for people to grasp sometimes when they're in the situation. What's going to happen long term is that this mesosystem is going to have to deal with events that take place. Graduations, school plays, concerts, athletic contests, weddings, birth of grandchildren. All of those events are going to impact both microsystems. They're going to impact the mesosystem. How the mesosystem deals with them determines how well the people have divorced, how successfully they have divorced. And what happens is that people use those events to increase the conflict, to assert their hostility, to take on roles that are inappropriate for the dyads. They do stupid things like announce, "Well, if he brings his new wife, I'm not coming to your wedding. I won't be in the same church with her." The appropriate answer? "Gee, Mom, that's too bad. We'll miss you." But what happens to kids caught in the middle is that they end up trying to mediate and trying to make everybody happy, and that shouldn't be the child's role, particularly when you're getting married. You just do it, and the other adults can behave stupidly if they want, but please not in my presence. Graduation. And it's important as you get older and you're the person in the middle, as some of you are, that you define the expectations. One of the nice things about becoming an adult is you tell your parents how to behave. "Mom, that's a totally inappropriate statement. It's my wedding. We want everybody there, and you can suck it up and behave like an adult for at least 4 or 5 hours. And you will avoid embarrassing yourself and making everybody else uncomfortable. Therefore, you are not permitted to drink." What happens when people drink? They embarrass themselves and make everybody else uncomfortable. If you know you have a parent who does that stupidity, you tell them they can't drink. They say, "I won't come if I can't be drunk." Tell them they're not welcome if they're drunk. Your expectation. Come to graduation, you don't have to sit together, but you do have to take me to lunch afterward. And you have to be civil. And you can both bring your new partners, even though I don't know them. I'm glad you didn't, but you can. If you can't be without them, you can both bring them. And all of us will go out to dinner or lunch, and I will expect you to celebrate my day, my accomplishments, and it's not about your divorce. It's not about your hostility. It's not about how badly she treated you 20 years ago. It's about me. If you can't do that, send money. And stay away. If you need it, I'll write scripts for you. I love writing scripts that are very clear. I do them with parents who are fighting over custody. I write scripts like, "Okay, my job is to evaluate you and make recommendations to the court about what happens to your kids. Here are my options. I can recommend to the judge that you both be taken out behind the barn and shot. I can recommend to the judge that your children be removed from your custody, your parental rights be terminated, and they be allowed to be adopted by people who would actually care for them, because you obviously don't. That gets people's attention. And I like getting people's attention when they are screwing up their parental roles. Okay. Let me throw in just a few comments about the macro system, because the macro system is changing very quickly. And one of the difficulties we have with divorce is that we have a set of old macro system beliefs. And we have a macro system that has changed. The laws have changed, our expectations have changed, and we need to help people catch up. The question is it important for children to know about their parents' past marriages before the children were born? It's probably not terribly important for kids to know, except that it's often a big surprise when you find out. You take HDFS 260, you do your family genogram, you go talk to your mother, you talk to your aunt, you discover that your mother was married twice before and you don't know about it. And you're 21, and kind of makes you wonder what other secrets the family has. Do I have any half-siblings out there? And people discover that they do, in fact. Lots of people have half-siblings that they don't know exist because they've been placed out for adoption. It's odd, the kinds of things that people think they don't want to talk about and don't share with their children. I don't think it's crucial that you know, but for example, if you understand that a parent has had a previous marriage and made some bad decisions and was out of control in her 20s, it might help you, if you understand that, it might help you understand your parent a little better. And it also might help you figure out better how to use your parent as a guide for your own life, what not to do, for example. I think it's helpful to know as much about one's family as possible, but it's not destructive if you don't. On the other hand, if the family has a pattern of hiding things and not talking about them, then that may mean that there's a pattern within the microsystem that might have some long-range complications. Families are likely to hide mental illness. They're likely to hide alcoholism. They're likely to hide abuse. And it's important for kids, I think, to understand some of the relationships in their extended family. It's helpful to understand why certain people don't talk to each other and why there's no relationship with them. And if that's because of sexual abuse, maybe you ought to know about that. But some families won't talk about it. What we've done in our society is to change the way we view divorce. And it's gone from we have a broken family where we've thrown out an incompetent parent to where we have a marriage that is dissolved and a binuclear family. And we don't need to dwell on whose fault it was. And that's a problem for many parents. Many people in divorce situations want the court to punish the other parent for being a bad person. And as my friend the judge says, I have no way of knowing whether the other person is a bad person. But I know you will come into court and get your friends to tell me the other parent is a bad person. I can't make the other person a good person. I don't believe your friends, anyway, and I don't believe you, because you're getting a divorce. Everybody's mad at everybody else. I think maybe you better start looking at the positive in the other person and help support that other person becoming a better person, because he or she is, after all, the other parent of your children. And you will share grandchildren someday, so maybe instead of fighting with each other and tearing each other down, you should figure out how to have at least a neutral dyadic relationship. We don't talk about alimony in Vermont. We have spousal support. And that spousal support is based on the unequal earning power in many families. If people do have unequal earning power, then spousal support is designed to bridge the period of time that it takes for the person with less earning power to come up to being able to be self-supporting. And that's usually time limited. So you may get spousal support for 3 or 4 or 5 years, and then you're expected to be able to make it on your own with appropriate child support, of course. We don't talk about custody. Custody and visitation are not words in Vermont law. They have been replaced by parental rights and responsibilities and parent-child contact. So lawyers and parents will talk about having custody. They don't in Vermont. They have parental rights, joint, sole, legal, physical. There are different combinations of those. But Vermont doesn't talk about visitation. Kids don't visit parents. They spend time with them. And you have a parenting agreement that determines how much time children spend with each parent. And the law was deliberately changed 10, 12, 15 years ago now, deliberately changed to alter the language, because language drives how people think about things. And by talking about parental rights and responsibilities, you recognize that you have two parents and they have responsibilities to their kids. So then you create parenting agreements that spell out how they're going to share that responsibility, how they're going to manage it when they're not living in the same household. We don't talk about broken homes. I don't allow people to use that phrase in my presence. We can talk about divorced families. Okay. And it's interesting to look at the change in the law and to look at the changes in our language and think about how they promote more positive relationships between the kids' microsystems and how they focus on the transactional nature of the relationship and the continuing dyad between a divorced couple. They are still both parents, though they don't live together. They are still both parents. Neither of them is relieved of that responsibility. And they have an obligation to create a co-parental relationship that is positive for the child. So the law in Vermont started with creating a family court that would focus on family matters and then changing the law so that it did not promote throwing out one parent. It did not promote the departure of one parent from the kids' lives. At the same time, the law was changed to promote equal division of assets and equal contribution or equitable contribution to supporting a child. And that was a real problem because it used to be that the best way to become poor in Vermont, if you looked at the number of people who entered the welfare system and went below the poverty line, the easiest way to do that, the most common way to do that, was to be a woman who got divorced and got custody of the kids. You automatically became poor. And men would negotiate for a child support payment that would pay for a pair of sneakers every couple of months, you know, if you needed them, but nothing else. So the law was changed so that the court just simply looks at everybody's finances and says, okay, here's what your kids need. And you both contribute this. Now you're both going to be poor. But you're going to be equally poor. And men have almost stopped screaming about that. Almost. Not quite. I still hear it. But to simply explain that your responsibility is to your kids, and if that means you can't buy a new snowmobile next year, tough shit. Your kids will have food, and they will not have to live in poverty. And that was done so that you and I wouldn't have to pay for those kids when their parents were perfectly capable of paying for them but refused to do that. Eventually, I used the word childish a while ago. That's another one I coined. It's like feminist. I think that children should be the focus of our lives. And what I expect to see, the macro system is still changing. We're not done with divorce yet. We're still moving along. And eventually, in about 20 years, what you're going to see is that when a couple of kids divorce, we're going to say, okay, when you had that child, you obligated yourselves to support that child. And now you are required to work. You may not quit. You're required to work. And we're going to take all of what you make from both parents. And we're going to assign it to a trustee. This is a job for you. And we're going to have the trustee raise your child well. Good home, molar activities, good meso system opportunities, developmental trajectories that will support the interests that they have, private schools maybe, whatever it takes. We're going to spend the money. And if there's anything left, meantime, we're going to put you in dormitories. Cooperative dormitories, you're going to have to garden and subsistence garden, and we'll support you a little bit. We're going to give you an allowance, and you're going to have to live four to a room and share cars and public transportation because we need the money for your kids. Okay, you see where this is going. And then if there's anything left over, we're going to give it to the parents proportionally, depending on how much quality time they've spent with the child. So the parent spends a lot of quality time with the child. That parent will get more of whatever the leftover money is. That's my fantasy. I have fun with attorneys suggesting that, but I'm not ready to draft the bill and put it into the legislature. So you probably won't see it for a while. I put up on the website a kind of summary of some of the important lessons to be learned about divorce, and I'm going to refer you to that. And I'm going to ask you, Greg is going to run up and down one aisle very, very quickly and pass out a piece of paper for you. Just take that and pass it. I'd like you to think about developmentology and convert it to a wish for yourself and your classmates. Just one or two things. Based on what you've learned about developmentology, what would you wish for yourself and your fellow students? Everybody have a sheet? Good. Yeah. Down here. You could just throw them. Be thinking.
people don't want to be embarrassed by having to read theirs. I had more time to think about it. So there's what I wish for you. Many wonderful primary dyads manifesting positive affect, a high degree of reciprocity, and a comfortable balance of power. Many developmental dyads, some in which you are the less developed person and some in which you are the more developed person. A lifetime of satisfying molar activities, some solitary, some joint. Harmonious, secure, and supportive home microsystems. A richly linked mesosystem system comprising settings that are engaging, challenging, and rewarding. An ecosystem favorably disposed to your development. Developmental trajectories through increasingly satisfying, rewarding, and productive settings, promoting patterns of motivation and activity that serve you and your society well. The ability to understand your ecosystem and to manage it effectively so that it supports your development and the development of those for whom you care. Opportunities to participate in a wide variety of macrosystems. Steady progress in the development of a more differentiated and valid view of your ecosystem and the skills necessary to maintain and improve your ecosystem. And Julie and Greg and I thank you for a very interesting and productive semester. We'll have a review session in 7 minutes. Oh, and turn your form in down here. You get a point.
We're going to want to remember to ask the construction people not to do that thing with the other person.
Yeah. Nope.